You're listening to Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. You're listening at www.wps1.org. You're also listening to KPOO 89.5, Poor People's Radio, here live in San Francisco. Also, you might be listening to our gracious host, the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery's website at www.sfacgallery.org. Or, possibly, you're listening to Frank Prattle, go figure. And today, extra, double, triple special guests. It's going to blow your mind with a tractor and then back up over it. This is going to be the best conversation you've ever heard. So I would get a firm seat and perhaps some adult diapers, and we'll get started. Three special guests today. Suzanne Cockrell, who is an artist and professor here at California College of the Arts. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Liz Thomas, who is the Phyllis Wattis Matrix Curator at the Berkeley Art Museum. Hi.
Hi, Zephyry.
And last but of course not least, Ted Purvis, an artist and also a professor at California College of the Arts.
Hi, Zephyry. Thanks for having us.
No problem. The larger umbrella that we've been talking about in the past couple interviews has been a discussion between public versus private and all the different ramifications and kind of side alleys that carries along with it. And we had spoken a little bit before the interview about how that comes into relation as far as artists doing things outside of museum context versus artists doing things inside museum context. And maybe we can just kind of start out with that. I don't know who wants to run with the ball.
I guess me, since people are
curators
pointing at me.
Curators first.
Yes. Curators first. No, artists first, Ted.
Let's speak at the same time.
Yes. Well,
and
I think.
Go.
Okay. I think that for me, the question of public versus private brings up a couple of issues working inside of a fairly large institution, although a large institution that tries to work like a small institution. The idea of public becomes very important when you're talking about a museum versus some kind of storefront alternative space or some sort of specifically artist-driven project that's even unsited, because there is a sort of belief or understanding that a museum serves a public in a very specific way with a sort of public trust that comes from funding, comes from audience, comes from membership, comes from all sorts of kind of social contracts and also sort of interests that come to the museum through these various channels. But I think it's also a function too of kind of how the audience gets invited in to institutions versus smaller artist-driven projects. You know, in an institution, the kinds of ways that I can do outreach or the kinds of ways that I can promote what I'm doing end up falling in sort of more formalized categories of publicity. And I think that there's something interesting about the idea of publicity going back to its roots in sort of being for the public rather than being a function of sort of marketing. And I really do believe that institutions should think of themselves that way. I'm not saying most museums do, but I really do think that that's the way that museums should think about themselves and drive their programs towards the widest possible audiences, although individual programs could be directed at very narrow audiences.
Sounds good. Either one of you want to jump in on that? I mean, both of you have recently run, just for the listening audience, an amazing project in Oakland that was run out of a storefront, where one of the venues was a storefront, called the Temescal Amity Works. Maybe talk a little bit about that and then kind of relate that to a museum context.
Yep. This was a project that Ted and I created and ran for about 3 years in our neighborhood in Temescal. That's a district in Oakland. And we opened the storefront in October of 2004, and we closed it the very first month of 2007. So we had about 3 years of operating there, 2.5 years. And it was, there were a lot of things that we were investigating and thinking about in that project. And one of them, I'll just start with talking about the crop sharing project, but we knew something about this neighborhood because we'd lived there on and off for about 6 or 7 years. So we knew, had been building sort of a knowledge of the neighborhood, settlers, things that had gone on there before. And so this project was really built on a kind of insider sort of information and knowledge of the history. And we created a crop sharing project. This is California. There's a lot of produce that is grown and fruit trees that are in everyone's backyards that were planted here by settlers and throughout the history of California. So we were interested in how do we build a kind of collective portraiture of a neighborhood and implicate ourselves in a project where we couldn't necessarily leave, you know, that we would be sort of working here. It wasn't a kind of public project where we would go into a community and do something and then, you know, just sort of take ourselves out of it or go to another community and translate it. So we were, we sort of were in for kind of a long haul. But the crop sharing project was sort of building on this sort of history of it being an orchard suburb. And Italian immigrants that had brought their farming techniques from Italy and planted citrus and rosemary and herbs and other vegetables and crops that were native to them in Italy. And the people that are now living in the neighborhood have inherited a lot of those trees and the remains of those farming practices. So we thought that we would, and it was, I think Ted, you could talk to it sort of in terms of it being an economy, but we set up a system whereby we would come and pick up or they could drop off fruit and we would redistribute it free in the neighborhood. So it was this idea of sort of recirculating a kind of produce that was already existing in the neighborhood and we're thinking of it as a kind of alternative economy that already was in place that we wanted to amplify and talk about and other things about that. Want to add something to that?
Yeah, I think one really important thing to just factor into that too was that the people who planted these crops, who settled the neighborhood by and large, used everything they grew, and that as time has moved on, that was actually in the 19-teens or 20s. And you know, most of those people don't live there anymore. They moved to the suburbs in the 60s. The neighborhood's gone through several demographic shifts since then. And people weren't, you know, one thing we readily notice is that, you know, fruit was rotting on the ground. That there's a basically, not only was there an economy, but it was underutilized and a dormant economy. So one of our notions was that the conversation actually might serve to I guess, sort of jumpstart it maybe to see if people could start thinking about what had been literally planned into the neighborhood, not by the architects, but by the people who then bought that first wave of houses, that there was a plan in place for a certain kind of non-capital but sort of backyard economy that had been seeded into the neighborhood and it was still there, you know? So that's I think, that was really the core of the project.
Inspiration.
The inspiration. And the trick is like, how do you get people involved? And our idea was to start a storefront rather than, you know, I think Liz can talk to that. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do public art projects, and you very often have to partner with people. And our idea was, you know, we could have partnered with the library or there's a local art center, but we decided instead that to open a store would be a really different way to create a presence, because a store is kind of a different kind of space. People interact with stores really differently than if they knew that there was an art project at the library,
right,
for
definitely.
Instance. And I think it creates a different set of social rules.
Well, and I think in the case of a storefront or in the case of something that really is made, produced, conceived wholly within the control of the people who are enacting the project, you know, we talk about the idea of public and private and somehow that private is necessarily a bad thing,
right.
You know, because it's not public, and yet sometimes that very privacy of decision making, of control, of kind of the nuance of how and when and in what manner things happen is actually an incredibly empowering thing. The problem is that those situations for artists to work privately are rare because the money usually comes through public venues, through public sources. And yet the kind of control that comes with privacy or sort of private enterprise is in some ways the most freeing, the most full of possibility for artists.
You look like you had a point there, Ted.
I did, but I didn't know if you wanted
to. No, go ahead.
I think just to follow up on that, I think it's something that we probably come back to today, because I think starting this notion of public and private is really interesting, because I think these things flip back and forth really quickly. Mm-hmm. And what at first appears to be, what at first appears to be, you know, the public art project actually was operating on a very private model, which is a store.
Right.
And that's, you know, and I think to be clear, we received public funding, but private foundation funding to start this project. It was one of, Creative Capital was a big backer of it, as was the Creative Work Fund, which is a really large local public project grant.
And so
kudos to them. And the Oakland Arts Commission kicked in some money, too.
Don't forget
them.
You were going to say something, Suzanne?
No.
Okay. one of the things that, I mean, Liz, as you brought up, one of the distinctions in the art world that often happens is that split between public and private. And one, you know, getting looked upon as kind of the money-grubbing bastards, as it were. That, you know, damn the private men, you know, or the women, what have you. They're only in it for the cash, and that's what Chelsea is for, you know? And then while the public sphere gets viewed as this kind of shining knight that, you know, is out to help the entire good. And, you know, obviously that's skewed and, you know, not you know, I'm not being...
Not true.
Not being very fair, and it's not true at all. But one of the things that I look at is the split in different fields outside of art, and that being, let's say you take healthcare, and the split between public and private exists there, where private healthcare across the board is considered the best. Like, if you have a child, you don't want public health care for that child. You don't want the child to wait in line for 2 weeks while they need a lung today, you know what I mean? And those different notions of how we come to interact with what is collectively shared versus what is privately shared in America. And tell me your thoughts on that for curating a museum, like in looking out supposedly for the, you know, the greater public good that you were talking about.
Well, that sort of mantle of the public institution, you know, as I spoke of in the very beginning, is something that, you know, some institutions take very seriously in terms of serving a public. And yet, I don't think that what happens in most public institutions and the level of decision making that happens only considers that. It considers the private market, it considers the sort of private interactions of board members, of curators, their motivations. I mean, there's a really complex sort of set of factors that make themselves known on any decision that happens in an institution. That said, you know, I work in a place where those factors are really largely minimized. And part of that is because I have a program that I run that has already an endowment and has money for the programmatic costs of the Matrix program, which is one of the oldest sort of artist project situations in any United States museum, 30 years old now, the program. And that very fact, that one fact, that a private individual would endow a program like this makes the program be able to behave in ways that are not typical to an institution, because I don't have to fundraise for individual projects to the same degree that I would in another situation. I don't have to answer to marketing committees or to sort of the situation of the museum in terms of long-range planning, because I have a certain pot of money to work with in making the program happen. So it allows my program, at least within a larger institution, to function much more like a Kunsthalle and much more like a sort of private enterprise inside the institution. That's not to say I don't consider the greater good of the institution and think about the sort of larger complexion of the institution when I do my programming, but it means that I can sort of act to support artists and to tolerate a certain amount of risk and uncertainty and doubt, which is, I think, what goes along with, if we're going back to these ideas of public and private, you know, private enterprise is much more comfortable with risk and doubt and uncertainty than public enterprises, if you think about something like, you know, the government versus private industry. And, you know, I never really thought about it this way, but I do think that an institution being able to behave that way, to tolerate risk and doubt and uncertainty and not knowing what a project is until 2 months before it's happening, you know, does kind of have some interesting parallels to those discussions.
Well, I mean, so you speak about kind of that greater freedom that you're allowed, and maybe we can talk about some of the projects that you've been working on that would bring artists such as, you know, Suzanne and Ted, who operate on a fairly, I would say, extra gallery level, no?
Yep.
And bringing those into the museum. And Ted and Suzanne, maybe you can talk a little bit about how you might be moving in that opposite trajectory, you know, going towards the gallery.
No, it's a big topic for us right now. Go for it.
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, one thing that we thought a lot about and tried to open up and make very present in our project at the storefront in Temescal was that we wanted other people to, thinking about authorship, that we were interested in other people coming and participating with us, maybe presenting proposals for things they would want to do in the storefront. So even though it had sort of semblance of a private enterprise, that it also had a very public sort of agenda of like bringing other people to involve them and to have them share their ideas or perhaps even make a proposal for something that they'd wanted to do and never had an opportunity to do. So there's a flexibility there. But we found also that there was a kind of, public or audience, right, that was sort of generated also over the course of the time. I'm here.
And Ted, did you want to dovetail into that as well, or?
No.
No.
Okay. Liz can go first.
All right.
She
okay.
looks ready.
I'm well.
Poised.
In thinking about a project that maybe relates to these discussions, there's a project that actually Ted and Suzanne participated in tangentially at the museum, which was a Matrix exhibition with an artist called Allison Smith, who's based out of New York. And Allison's work in general has to do with an interest in history, and in particular in craft and sort of different disciplines of making. Historically, that can have an impact in the present moment in terms of the ways in which the handmade, the ways in which the sort of individual voice has a very deeply political resonance now. And for the Matrix project, we had her enact a project originally taking place in Britain, here in the Bay Area, called Notion Nanny. And Notion Nanny is a character from history, one who was a sort of itinerant peddler who traveled the countryside with her wares in a basket, sort of an early entrepreneur in a sense, and an early public artist, you know, literally holding out her wares and displaying her wares for consumption by the public. The project in the museum involved both an exhibition with a lot of objects, actually a lot of made things that Allison made on her own and also in collaboration with different kinds of traditional makers. So in Britain, she worked with a lot of lace makers and textile people and tin workers. Here in the Bay Area, she worked with a lot of people, not surprisingly, working in the arts and crafts paradigm in terms of tile making or textiles or stained glass, but also with other artists in town. So part of that project, you know, the sort of typical museum part of that project is an exhibition with objects, with sort of a larger narrative wrapped up around it in the space for people to come and experience. But the thing that was most important to me was this day of demonstrations that we made out in the balcony of the museum, out in the most public space of the museum, where we invited local makers, including Ted and Suzanne, and many other great people. Aaron Toole came down as well, who's a Berkeley person, who is a ceramicist, who makes cups related to war.
And war cups.
War cups, yes. Ted can speak about him as well, having written beautifully about his work before. So this day was meant to be a day of demonstrations, both of skills but also of ideas, and how the idea of tradition can within it have inscribed revolution as a sort of basis of its meaning. And it was a really amazing day with this sort of spirit of community outside of the museum, sort of untied to the exhibition completely separately. And there was something really wonderful about a museum being able to have this kind of festival atmosphere that really had nothing to do with the production of an exhibition. You know, I could have done that exhibition without an exhibition. I could have done that by doing a series of demonstrations, and I would have been happy about that. Of course, being in an institution, one always has the issue of trying to have a sort of trace remain, and that in many ways becomes the largest issue of working this way within institutions, because a lot of projects like this, the trace, the kind of document, the kind of
the ephemera, what have you, yeah.
Or even for something physical to be able to try and represent any kind of exchange is a difficult thing to ask of an object. You know, exchanges are not represented in objects, largely. And in the case of this project, they were represented through collaborative objects that were made between Allison and different artisans, or in the case of the Day of Demonstrations, by objects in concert with their makers. Literally, they are in conversation with one another and with the public. But that, you know, in a sense, thinking about the storefront project, you know, there's almost no way to translate that to an institution.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was going to say, I mean, I think some of these ideas that Liz was just talking about are pretty active for us, because I think one of the interesting things that happened is that, for probably a host of reasons, as the longer that we did the project in the neighborhood, people became more interested in the art world, in what we were doing, and there was in some of the ideas that we were dealing with, which had to do with sort of microeconomies and things like that, neighborhood dynamics, community activism, green living, all this sort of stuff, are ideas that a lot of curators in institutions are really interested in working into their museum programs right now. So that since this project, we have been invited to be in some group shows or to do pieces for museums. And I think exactly the kind of thing that Liz was just talking about has come into our, you know, onto our radar now. And we're sort of thinking about how do we translate, or how do we move really what we were doing, because it doesn't work. You couldn't really do a community project in a museum in any satisfactory way. I think it would just be compromised mm-hmm. on both sides, and not maybe the best use of time, but for us to think of, we've been thinking about how do these things move in well. And I don't know, should I just talk about our project we're about to do?
Yeah.
Just to quickly interject though, before you go into that, which I'm dying to hear about,
yeah.
is I know that many times there have been critiques of people who do community-based work, who then move that community-based work to a different location, and then, you know, try to repeat that phenomenon, but without that kind of, you know, 6-year route that you have there already, you know, it becomes, you know, some have said, and not obviously, you know, criticizing you guys, but some projects have become superficial in that
yep.
way, and no longer operate. And what has been your guys' experience as you get larger and are asked to, you know, travel around the world? I know that you were in Sweden this summer,
yep.
And doing community projects in other places. I mean, is it still relevant?
It's a great. I mean, I think that this is a question that haunts. It doesn't haunt us, but I think it's a kick in the pants kind of question that has caused us to really think about, like, how do you make that transition, but make it real? Mm-hmm. Not how do you make real community art happen in a museum, but maybe like what's a real assessment of those things that we're interested in, how do they move? I mean, I think I'll just talk about the piece in Sonoma, and maybe you can talk about the San Jose piece.
Mm-hmm.
Our first opportunity was to be in a show called Hybrid Fields, which was about a year and a half ago in Sonoma, which is a museum in Santa Rosa, California, which to the New York audience is, it's a small town. It's, you know, it's probably about the same size as like Woodstock or something
I
like that.
I think Tom Waits lives there though, no?
He does, indeed.
He does.
There's lots of, yeah, Bonnie Raitt probably doesn't live too far away either. It's, you know, but anyway, it's, you know, first off, it's in the middle of a farming county. There's tons of agricultural production going on there, especially wine and apples, things like that. So everything that we were about in Oakland didn't need to really be talked about there, and yet here we are asked to be in a show. And so what we decided to do in this context, and I think with a lot of this in mind, we like museum shows. You know, we didn't do the storefront thing because we hate museums. You know, it's really nice to go to museums and look at things, and really our idea was like, how do we actually make something to look at?
Although, you know, initially we were asked to come up to the museum and bring our cart, you know, which we use to collect
it,
produce.
Yeah.
Yeah, to repeat it basically, or to put our tools on display, or to, you know, do some crop sharing project up there, which made no sense at all
yeah.
in terms of it being an agricultural county. So it gave us an opportunity to think through what's most essential for us to talk about at the heart of this practice we've been doing in Oakland, and take that
right.
and try to bring that to that context. So continue.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I think, so what we decided to do basically was to play with the situation a bit more, to think about like, it's a county art museum, but it also has sort of a historical mandate. So basically what we decided to do was to hold a preserved food contest in the gallery, and that over the course of about 2 months, people, anybody in the county could bring something they'd preserved that didn't need to be refrigerated. It could be anything, really. And
what did people bring?
People brought all sorts of stuff. They brought what?
Fig vinegar.
Olives.
Fig vinegar?
Yeah, great
stuff.
Was
one of our winners. And then we had
dried
olives.
Dried tomatoes.
Sun-dried tomatoes in oil, which
yeah.
were
all sorts
amazing.
Of good stuff. Blackberry jelly. I mean,
jams, jellies, pickles.
And they're beautiful, you know. And so, but the flip side was that we, in doing this, we got the museum to agree to put up a $100 first prize.
A blue ribbon, if you will.
Whoa,
a blue ribbon,
budget.
Which is more
big
than you would
budget.
Get at the state fair, where you just would get a ribbon and no prize.
Right.
But that we also, the other big part of the piece was that we got the museum to agree to accession the winner into their permanent collection. So it was our, it was fun. But it was like, it's like how do you, like how can we play? I mean, the idea is like doing this sort of agricultural thing in a museum is absurd. So how do we actually make some play with that situation and think about who's collecting, who's preserving? All of these things in a way are about collecting and preserving. So how can we muddy the waters in a way? And we had the tasting day was like a total, I mean, I think it had a lot of vibe to what Liz was talking about in terms of the day of demonstrations. People came, we had judges, there were like, you know, there was a radio show host, it was one of the judges, there was one of the trustees, was one of the judges. Anyway, so.
We had an art collector.
We had an art collector.
From
yeah.
San Francisco.
Who was it?
Stephen Lieber.
Stephen
all
Lieber, right, yeah. Right. So it was.
Did he buy
who's
anything?
Also, he's sort of a gourmand.
No, but he tasted
too.
Everything.
Yeah. They had to taste everything. And so anyway, and then everybody could come eat. It was really fun. So we got to disassemble the installation and everybody got to taste it, which was, it was great anyway. So that's, I think, in a way, like, how do you get to some of the ideas without necessarily repeating the, like, the public grassrootsy kind of mm-hmm. project, but how do you actually talk about economy and people preserving and what about, why are people still, you know, nobody needs to preserve their own olives in a way, but it's kind of great that they are, and maybe they do need to, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. that there's a lot of issues up, so.
Mm-hmm. I think before Suzanne talks about the other project, I just want to maybe talk about some of the impulses for why museums want to do things like this, which, you know, has to do with, you know, the museum, and anyone who reads theory can find plenty about this, the idea of the museum as mausoleum, the idea of museum talking about collections as a place of dead things.
Right.
More and more in contemporary life, there's a sense that museums and the rhetoric in museums currently always centers around sort of making them a place of life, making them a place of community involvement, making them a place where things happen. You know, whether institutions decide to do that through, you know, cocktail parties on Friday nights for singles, or through projects themselves like these, or through, you know, concerts, through
education
programs, through outreach. You know, there's a real sense that the museum as an institution has to be about bodies and events and things happening, not just objects. And the, you know, when I worked at the Walker, the whole rhetoric around the new Walker was that Kathy Halbreich, the director at the time, was trying to make it a new community forum. Think about the museum as town square, as a place where a community chooses to gather for purposes that have to do with art, but also for purposes that have to do with community, basically.
Does that mean they'll let people crawl on the Charles Ray sculpture there, or?
I don't think so. I don't think it extends that far. But I do think, you know, institutions are really thinking in all different ways about how to make themselves relevant, you know, and the worst part of that phenomenon is some idea of the blockbuster or some idea of entertainment as the paradigm through which museums have to compete with other, I won't say cultural institutions, but with other kinds of, you know, things that people like to do in their free time. And, you know, so I find projects like this interesting because they are about literally sort of drawing the community into a situation of an exhibition or an institution, and sort of asking people to think about institutions in different ways and about their relationship to them in different ways, which gets back to the entire question of the public and sort of what the public thinks is going to happen in a museum or in a private space of interaction in terms of a storefront project, and sort of what their expectations are and how those are met or changed or exceeded through projects like this.
Dynamite. Suzanne, do you want to tell us about the next project as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that we really were excited about with the project in Sonoma is that people brought their preserves into the show, but maybe they'd never been to that museum before. They might have been something that they would have submitted to the county fair, right? So we were sort of interested in how do you bring new people into the museum, and we're sort of following on this a little bit with our next project. We were asked to be in a group show at the Institute for Contemporary Art in San Jose, and this actually opens up in a month from now. And this is a project that is called This Show Needs You. So they are, most of the projects are artists who are dealing with this sort of blurring of art and life and doing different range of dealing with the public, I would say. Some are actually just taking place in the gallery, but some are quite interactive as well.
There's some on-the-street interview kind of projects, but yeah. Anyway.
Right. So this, we are actually going to be, we've asked people to drop off lemons, or we will go and pick up lemons. So we're sort of following with this backyard sort of idea of backyard battery in this instance. The title for this project is, I think, should we say this on the air, Ted?
Yeah, let's commit to
unveil it.
Yeah, we were like.
Wait.
Ba-ba-ba.
Drum roll.
Everlasting lemon.
No, lemon everlasting.
Lemon everlasting.
No, wait, it's going to be both of those. With you guys saying it, one in each voice.
Everlasting.
No, lemon.
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 Lemon everlasting. Backyard battery.
Is the name of the piece.
Good, I like it.
So this is, again, we're pickling lemons, and we're asking people to bring in their lemons to have them preserved in salt and water and juice. And so the exhibition will begin with people dropping off their produce. We'll preserve them, and they will preserve and sit in salt over the exhibition, time of the exhibition, about 3 weeks it takes, I think, to
the
set
show,
up preserved lemons.
The show's about the right amount of time, yeah.
Yeah.
To do two batches.
Yep. And then we'll have a meal at the end. Yeah. And we actually, I think there will be a official Lemon Day. Right. A representative from San Jose.
The city council is going to actually declare that day to be San Jose Lemon Day. So, which is kind of a nice public arm twisting. But it's worth mentioning too that we're collaborating with the third person on this is a guy named Joe McHenry, who is someone who used to just come to Amity Works and talk about food. And it turned out that he knew a lot. He came almost every week for the last year we were open, and that he knew, he was just a food enthusiast.
One of our regulars.
So we decided to work with him on this because he's great. And he just knows, he is excited about preserving and talking to people about food. And I think that's going to really push this project along. Mm-hmm. One thing I think that we're real excited about is that the space of the show, this is kind of a formally thing, but that the space of the show actually does the work, right? So that when the show, that you actually, there's a reason to leave something in the gallery for 3 months, not just to be looked at, but that space of time actually is going to, it's enough to.
It's temperature controlled.
Temperature controlled. It's going to pickle these lemons. Yeah. There's enough, and that.
It's not too bright.
Exactly. Yeah. There's not going to be any sunlight, all the good stuff. And so that they'll actually be doing some real work, like the work is going to actually be happening in the show.
Although the interactive part of it is that with preserved lemons, you have to turn them over every now and then. So
right. The
public will come in and turn over the jars and shake them up.
Yeah.
So now I've never had a preserved lemon before. Mm-hmm. And is it similar to a candied lemon in that way? Or can you give a brief description? Because I'm dying to know.
Delicious. They're sour and salty, and they break down the lemons so that you could use them in salad dressings, or you would. It's a Moroccan staple, I think, for Moroccan food. So you would. I think we're going to be actually making some chicken.
Right.
Some lemon chicken, but they're. How would you describe them? You've had them, Liz.
I think the most common place you'd encounter them is in a big chicken and. Cooked with black olives and preserved mm-hmm. lemons and dumped on top of a plate of couscous. I mean, I think like that's sort of like, or rice, I think it's a very much that kind of, it's not sweet, it's salty.
Salty,
very
okay,
salty.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a savory fan as well, so
I
look forward. Liz, though, you look like you were going to say something, no? So maybe just to talk, one of the things that I'm completely, completely and utterly in love with is the idea of artists who break out of that insular capacity to just talk about art on art's terms, about art, about the thing I saw last week at the museum, and how that's going to shape my next show at the museum, and how I just sold it at my gallery to the person who's going to buy it for the next museum, and how that vicious circle never tends to break out, and you have self-reflexive art that, you know, is the snake eating its own tail constantly. And I think that you guys, and, you know, your curating as well, Liz, has tended to break out of that. And maybe if you could talk about some of the things that you've been looking towards for inspiration outside of an art context, outside of your art fairs, biennales, all that BS, you know, what are you looking for, you know, in the distance, you know? Not everybody wants, you know. Liz, go for it.
Okay, I'll give them some time to think. Well, I actually come from a background in anthropology contemporaneous to studies in art history and before my graduate studies. So my kind of understanding of how art can function in our world, you know, has to do with how it impacts and reflects aspects of daily life or not so daily life, you know, and that art is a place to work out ideas about how we ourselves make sense of ourselves in the world. So most of the projects that I work on, you know, tend to have some resonance, some sort of connection back to some larger cultural idea, whether it tries to be necessarily of its moment in some very specific way in terms of the trendiness of certain ideas. I don't necessarily think that way, although that is a certain way of thinking about curating. But I do sort of ask that of all the artists and all the art that I work with, is that there's something about it that opens itself up to the world. And that's not just a personal reflection, but that's, again, going back to this idea of publicity and sort of publicness, like I think that that's really important to consider, that anyone who walks through the door should be able to find an avenue through which to connect to the work, whether they love it or not, whatever kind of judgment they make to it or not, that there is something, you know, that can be communicated through the work to a person, right? So whether that's in the case of Allison Smith's project having to do with craft and making, you know, questions about the individual or questions about the persistence of the handmade in this present moment, that I think open themselves up to all kinds of discussions about alternative economies, about sort of the global marketplace versus people who choose to shop in their own neighborhoods. You know, it has like this much greater resonance about it. Or the current project I'm working on with Trevor Paglen, who's a geographer and artist working out of UC Berkeley, whose project has to do with the tracking and imaging of surveillance satellites that track and image us, and how that is an issue that is very much present for every single person on this planet, even if we're not conscious of these things happening to us. So, you know, for me, people like Ted and Suzanne, who are artists, but foremost sort of people in the world who have engaged ideas, who have an interest in understanding things larger than themselves, things about the world around them, you know, that's where I find the most compelling ideas to come from, the most compelling kinds of engagements with the world to come from. And oftentimes that involves other people, you know, but sometimes that involves merely the consideration of an idea in a new way.
Ted, Suzanne?
No, I think just sort of building on that a little bit, I think that, you know, this project, the Amity Works project, I very much make work that's directly coming out of my own life choices and lifestyle. And I think we had made a decision that we had a child and we were interested in having a local experience, having a local life, which we could walk to work, we could walk to the supermarket, we didn't have to be in cars all the time, we could stroll our kid around. There was something about that experience that was important for us to also translate into the work that we were making. So I think that life changes, you know, or life choices also are reflected in the kinds of ideas that you want to explore in your artwork. And in that way have a kind of integrity and sort of buy-in and sort of meaning that are sort of transformative for oneself, as well as the kind of conversations that you can have with people. You know, they're sort of grounded in a kind of everydayness that I think made the work have a bigger picture, you know, and have a bigger meaning, you know.
And I think, you know, I think that that definitely, I mean, I think that there was something about the kind of art work or art world that we'd been in prior to this project that was very, it was always something you had to go to. And it was, you know, especially after we had a kid, it wasn't always something that you could bring a kid to. And it's like, at a certain point, it was like, what's up with that? You know, that's, what? Why is that what we want to do? And maybe we can really reorient this. But I think also for both of us, and I can speak more directly for myself, it was also a way to connect to stuff that didn't have much to do with art, but had a lot to do with my own, you know, my own growing up, or just we, you know, I grew up on in a little farm town in Illinois, and I hated this stuff when I was a kid. You know, we had like 7 apple trees and plum trees, and I loathed it. I, you know, but we had to preserve this fruit every weekend all through the fall, and it was just like a bummer. But somehow it's funny to come back to it, and it's not a bummer again anymore. And there was something, for better or worse, there was something that was kind of encoded there about the economy. We weren't farmers, you know, my father was a teacher, but he made this decision in the 70s to kind of move back, you know, like a lot of people in the 70s, to kind of go a little bit back to the land, you know, and yeah, like I said, I don't, you know, at the time it stunk, but now it's really interesting to sort of come back to that and to sort of re-experience this. And some of this stuff, when we had to learn how to can, we didn't know how to can anything, really, except from what we remembered as from being kids.
Watching my mother.
Yeah, your mother.
Our grandmother.
Yeah. And you, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you know, and this is strictly a testament to how much I've been brainwashed by America, is that when I think of canning, like the immediate thought that pops into my head afterwards is botulism. And I'm just like, I can't help it. And maybe it's because, you know, I'm like, I'm hardwired to, you know, fatality,
yep.
You know, but what has been your experience with like, kind of like, you know, how do you tell? Like, is the top pops up? Like what? How do you tell if it's bad?
Smell. The top pops up, that's for sure. I mean,
top pops up. I mean, you know, we haven't had really any firsthand issues with them, but I think you kind of know that, like, one year, you have a year, right? When something is usually, you know, within a year, you can still eat it. But yeah. I don't know. I think we were super careful, but a lot of the general public's really scared.
I know.
In the same way.
Am I out in left field or no?
No.
People, okay. Not at all. And they also don't realize how simple it is. You know, in terms of, and that if you're doing something wrong, it's pretty hard to do something wrong, actually.
Well, it's just hard to do something wrong that's gonna hurt you. The worst it's gonna do is taste bad or not set up or something like that. But anyway, yeah. So.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's about all the time we have.
Okay.
A cheery note to end on.
and cut, death. You're listening to Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Throld. You're listening to WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate at www.wps1.org. You're also listening to KPOO, Poor People's Radio, 89.5 FM here in San Francisco. In addition, you might be listening to our gracious host, San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery at www.sfacgallery.org, and of course at frankprattle.com. Today, my special guests, hilarious, talking about death, one of my favorite subjects. Suzanne Cockrell, who is an artist here in San Francisco and also a professor at California College of the Arts. Thank you so much. Liz Thomas, who's the Phyllis Wattis Matrix Curator at the Berkeley Art Museum. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ted Purvis, who's an artist and also a professor at the California College of the Arts.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
And we'll talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.